folks, welcome back to Indaba Africa. This is Chris once again. Hello, folks, and welcome back once again to Indaba Africa. This is Chris, here to discuss yet another topic of interest covering Africa. Today, I'm wearing my USA 2011 Road Rugby jersey from the 2011 World Cup because today we're going to be talking about debunking the myth of sanctions on Zimbabwe. And so with that in mind, let's go ahead and get started right into this. On the 7th of March, 2003, President George Walker Bush signed Executive Order 13288. This was the first effort to put travel restrictions and economic restrictions on individuals and entities in Zimbabwe as a consequence of their undermining of democratic institutions, as was called for in the executive order. Now, that was on the 7th of March, 2003, fully 3 years after farm invasions and occupations, the murder of farm workers, political intimidation, the stealing of elections took place in Zimbabwe. 3 years after the fact. So it's March 7th, 2003, Executive Order 13288. Now, this was followed on November 22nd, 2005 by Executive Order 13391, which expanded the designation criteria for those individuals, specially designated nationals, as they're called, SDNs, and entities that could be included. And that annex is the one that remains active today with these executive orders and additional legislation that's gone along with this. On July 25th of 2008, President Bush signed Executive Order 13469. And that one allowed for blocking the property and interest in property of individuals and entities that are listed in the annex to Executive Order 13391. So I mentioned that. Okay, so let's move on from this. Why am I talking about this? Well, since he's come into office, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, as President of South Africa, has repeatedly called for the end of sanctions on Zimbabwe, blaming the sanctions for Zimbabwe's economic woes and the political troubles that take place in the country, and that if only the sanctions were lifted, Zimbabwe could thrive. For their part, the officials from ZANU-PF in Harare, beginning with Robert Gabriel Mugabe and continuing on now through Emmerson Mnangagwa and other members of the government, have repeatedly blamed sanctions for the reason that Zimbabwe's economy has collapsed and been utter chaos largely since the year 2000. But that does explain what happened the first 3 years prior to the sanctions taking place. Now, they are listed as sanctions by the U.S. government, but they're really travel restrictions, and I'll talk more about that shortly. But the reason I mention this is Ramaphosa last year in March, on the 5th of March, called for the end of sanctions in his role as South African president. Why is it important today? Well, because on April 22nd of this year, 2020, President Ramaphosa, in his role as the African Union chair, called once again for the lifting of sanctions against Zimbabwe, saying that it was necessary in this time of COVID-19. What I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, is that this is either a very poor understanding of what is actually happening here, or an intentional effort by Ramaphosa and others to distort the argument about what's happening in Zimbabwe. Believe me, if you lift these sanctions against Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe's economy is not going to recover or improve for various reasons. I'll talk about a few of those here shortly. So this all comes back. And what really disturbs me about this argument is you have an endless propaganda game. I understand why ZANU-PF has a propaganda game, because it's in their interest and they're frustrated. The members of the government who are restricted from travel and those who have a majority share in state-owned enterprises or private companies that are affected by these restrictions, obviously they have an interest in that. So that is why they will spread propaganda and distort the argument about what's actually happening. There are no sanctions on the people of Zimbabwe. There are no restrictions. For instance, if I, as a private individual or investor, desire to invest in Zimbabwe, there are no constraints by my government to prevent me from doing so. I can transfer cash. I can send my resources to Zimbabwe. I can set up business there. And there is nothing from the U.S. government, unless I do business with the individuals who are under targeted restrictions and or the 56 entities, companies. So we're talking about the Office of Foreign Assets Control. This is the organization responsible from the Department of Treasury in concert with the Department of State. And so this is a list. This is a publicly available document. It's not classified. Anyone can get this. So if you want to be informed and get rid of the propaganda, simply do a search on Google and go to the Treasury Department and download this. And this will give you a list of all the different things that take place under these sanctions for Zimbabwe. So, as I mentioned, the executive order in 2008, so the current sanctions up through that, including legislation that's come along since then, block the property and interest in property of individuals and entities listed in Annex to Executive Order 13391 or that are determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State. Two, these are the only things that are on any restrictions by the U.S. government. Now, I'm not speaking for the European Union, but specifically for the U.S. government. So, must be a senior official in the government of Zimbabwe, all right? Now, that's not all senior officials in the government of Zimbabwe, but must be official and senior official. Must be owned or controlled by, directly or indirectly, the government of Zimbabwe or an official or officials of the government of Zimbabwe. Must have engaged in actions or policies that undermine Zimbabwe's democratic processes or institutions. Must be responsible for or have participated in human rights abuses related to political repression in Zimbabwe. And be engaged in or have engaged in activities facilitating public corruption by senior officials of the government of Zimbabwe. Beyond that, they must be a spouse or dependent child of any person whose property, interest, and property are blocked pursuant to the executive orders, the three that I've listed, or an immediate family member or of any person whose property and interest in property are blocked pursuant to Executive Order 13391. To have materially assisted, sponsored, or provided financial, material, logistical, or technological support to the government of Zimbabwe, any senior official, or any person blocked pursuant to the executive orders. Or be owned, controlled, or act on behalf of any person blocked pursuant to the executive orders. So, what does this mean? Well, in effect, what it means today, with the most recent updated information as of October 2019, before the restrictions were extended yet again this year in 2020, is that the list of individuals which one time was approaching 190 is down to just 85 individuals who have restrictions on them in Zimbabwe and 56 companies or organizations. But also there's a ban on the sale of arms and munitions to Zimbabwe as the U.S. government is concerned that such things could be used to repress the population. So travel restrictions, which means that these people on the list cannot come to the United States, and for the European Union, same situation takes place. But travel restrictions can't come to the United States. Freezing their assets here in the United States. A ban on the sale of military hardware. Those are the restrictions under the sanctions program for Zimbabwe. Nowhere in there does it say that no one is allowed to transfer cash, that people cannot do business with Zimbabwe. That is simply not true. Yet that is the propaganda argument we've been hearing for some time. Now, even for those who are banned, there are exemptions. If you look under this policy, there are specific exemptions and transactions that can be, and if you feel that you need to do business with one of the people on this list or they're unjustly there, you can appeal to these executive orders and the laws, and you can get an exemption and be able to do business and work with these folks. So I mentioned three executive orders, but there's also two statutes, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, U.S. Code 50.88-1701-1-1706, and the National Emergencies Act, U.S. Code 50, once again. The Code of Federal Regulations, which specifically addresses Zimbabwe sanctions regulations, and several Federal Register notices for the final rule, the revisions, and new regulations, all tied to the executive orders. So there you have the things that are actually in place. Now, why is this important? Well, it is very important because we consistently hear folks call for the end of sanctions. Cyril Ramaphosa is arguing that we should end the sanctions and it will end Zimbabwe's misery. Well, that's simply not the case. Zimbabwe is in the situation that it's in owing to the macroeconomic decisions of the leadership of Zimbabwe in ZANU-PF. The reason the U.S. has sanctions on them is because the government has oppressed and abused its own citizens. Human rights abuses, political repression, murders, assassinations, things like this. And that is the reason for these targeted sanctions. And they're not broad-based to prevent people from doing business in Zimbabwe because that would harm the people of Zimbabwe. So there was a BBC article. They have a mechanism which they call reality check. It's really a fact checker. So when issues come up, they take a look at it. So the most recent from them is from 25 October of 2019, so just about 6 months ago or so, they ran an article. And in the article, they talked about the push for lifting sanctions against Zimbabwe. Now, in this, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Tibor Nagy, says exactly the argument that I've been making for 17 years with Zimbabwe. And even before that, during the 2000 stomping of farmers, the farm invasions, 2001, 2002, We had officials from Zimbabwe claiming that there were sanctions on Zimbabwe, which is simply an outright lie. There were no sanctions whatsoever. It wasn't until 2003 that the first restrictions came in place, and it affected targeted individuals and entities, not Zimbabwe as a whole. But Tibor Nagy recently said, we have sanctions against certain individuals and certain corporations, not against the country of Zimbabwe. There is nothing to stop U.S. businesses from investing in Zimbabwe, from going to Zimbabwe. That's correct, and I've been saying that for 17 years. However, Zimbabwe in the past has taken action, particularly in 2008, to discriminate and defraud foreign direct investors, which has discouraged people from investing in Zimbabwe's economy. And I'll talk about that here shortly as we discuss this a little bit further. So travel restrictions, a freeze on assets, and the ban on sale of military hardware and equipment, which might be used for internal repression. Now, reality check for the BBC took a look at this. Are, in fact, sanctions to blame for Zimbabwe's economic woes? Because the government of Zimbabwe regularly blames these sanctions from the European Union and from the United States as the reason for their poor or dire economic performance, as the BBC stated. But there's little evidence, according to the BBC, to suggest that U.S. or EU sanctions are responsible for Zimbabwe's troubles. For its part, the U.S. Department of State recognizes that the restrictions that are in place do affect Zimbabwe, but specifically it affects the people that it's targeted at. So those who are in possession of farms and who have committed these acts and are senior members of the government are not getting any benefit from that, from a relationship with the United States. And so it does affect those farms, but that does not affect the country on a broader scale. Now, this is interesting from Karen Pindariri, who is a lecturer in the Department of Economics at the University of Zimbabwe. This is not the kith and kin in the United Kingdom. This is not the United States. This is not the European Union, who are supposedly crippling Zimbabwe's economy. This is an economist based at the University of Zimbabwe in Harare. So Karen Pindari said that data from 1980 to 2015 shows no evidence sanctions had a negative effect on formal employment and poverty in Zimbabwe. Now that's interesting, very interesting. So let me shift now to talk about, while these restrictions have been in place and travel bans have been in place for 17 years and renewed repeatedly by successive administrations, by George Bush, by Barack Obama, and now by Donald Trump, the U.S. government since 2003 has provided over $4 billion in direct grant assistance to Zimbabwe. $4 billion, ladies and gentlemen. That's correct. I didn't mumble. I didn't stumble. This is a matter of public record. You can look it up. Go search for it and find out how much. So we remain the single largest donor to Zimbabwe and the largest provider of healthcare and humanitarian assistance for the country and the people of Zimbabwe, even in the midst of these restrictions and sanctions against targeted individuals who have committed repression or at least are accused of it. So in 2019, U.S. government, for example, provided $318 million in foreign assistance to Zimbabwe in health development and humanitarian assistance. Health development and humanitarian assistance. These are programs like PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, which benefit Zimbabwean citizens directly, not ZANU-PF. Were it not for the $318 million a year that the U.S. is spending there, things would be truly dire in Zimbabwe, particularly in the healthcare sector. Now, why else do I mention this? Well, I mention this because amongst the propaganda that we get from Zimbabwe, which is expected, we see others in Africa calling for lifting of sanctions. My question to these other leaders in Africa, do you understand what these are about? This is not because of farm invasions, and I'll talk about that in a second. It's not about that at all. This is about political repression and human rights abuses and suppression of speech in Zimbabwe and the press in particular at this point. That's why this is taking place. So why is it only Western Europe and the United States, and for a brief period of time under Ian Khama, Botswana, stand up for the citizens of Zimbabwe? The 4 million who've been forced to flee the country and live abroad, or the 14 million or so who live in the country today? Why are we the ones who are the guardians of freedoms and liberties for the Zimbabwean people? By putting these targeted measures in there to ensure that the people who have profited from abusing Zimbabweans don't profit any further. Yet it's not simply African leaders and Zimbabwe's ZANU-PF, it is also their fellow travelers around the world. This is a recent article that's been published in multiple locations from what appear to be leftist, socialist, or even communist sympathizers or actual communists. So this is an article by Robin Davis, Onyesonwu Chatover, and Nancy Wright. And they talk about the sanctions and how it's illegal and immoral for the United States to have sanctions and the harm that it does. And while there's certainly fair arguments to be made about the utility, the efficacy, and the harm that sanctions can do on a country, and we can look at cases where countries who had total sanctions have suffered consequences that affect the entire population. We can look at that. But in the case of Zimbabwe, this is the small section that they wrote. I'll read it to you in its entirety, and then I will debunk it sentence by sentence. So they write for the section of Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe is one of several African nations subjected to U.S. and European sanctions. Angered by Zimbabwe's implementation of a program to reclaim and redistribute land stolen by European settlers during the ruthless Rhodesian rule, the U.S. and Europe have worked tirelessly to cast Zimbabwe into total economic ruin. While European settlers stole land, displaced and killed African people, stole mineral wealth, there were no sanctions or any action taken against them by any European country or the United States. Once African people overthrew the brutal invaders and began redistributing land to the rightful owners, Europe and the U.S. sought to bring down the Zimbabwe government through crushing sanctions, plunging the economy into a crisis designed to starve people. Now, what is disturbing about this, ladies and gentlemen, is just a tissue of lies. This is utter nonsense. No disrespect for the authors, but they clearly have an agenda here, and they have an inability to state the facts. Now, are we biased? Of course, everyone has their personal biases, and I bring my own bias to this. But my bias is in favor of the Zimbabwean people and the facts of history. So let me talk about that. Let me talk about this specifically. So, angered by Zimbabwe's implementation of a program to reclaim and redistribute land. Really? It took 3 years for George Bush, in a fit of anger, for 3 years to address the question of Zimbabwe? If it was about land stolen, why weren't these sanctions applied in June of 2000? July, August, September, October, November, December, when hundreds of farm workers were murdered, political opponents were repressed, assassinated, and farmers, commercial farmers themselves were also murdered, like David Livingstone and others. Why did this not take place then? It didn't take place then. This is in response to continued political repression, undermining of democracy in Zimbabwe. The people who perpetuate those actions should not have the benefit and access to our market and our credit and our trade with them. Now, the people of Zimbabwe, different story. The 14 million people plus the 4 million are forced to live in exile. That's a different story. They are entitled to trade with the U.S. They're in good standing. So it was not about angered over farm invasions. That's utter lunacy. It doesn't even pass the common sense test. All right, to reclaim and redistribute land stolen by European settlers during the ruthless Rhodesian rule. Yes, there was land that was taken from Black Africans during Universal Declaration of Independence, UDI period, from 1965 until 1979. That's a true statement. Absolutely. But that was a portion of the land in Rhodesia, not all the land in what became Zimbabwe. It completely neglects the reality that from 1980 until the year 2000, 42% of all commercial farmland in Zimbabwe was sold at least one time. Some of that land was sold on multiple occasions. That's just what happens with farmland. People transfer it. Someone else buys it to do something else with it. Farmland is typically sold. Look at any country around the world in which people have title to land. You'll find that land is currently on sale. Farmland. You can buy farmland or forestry anywhere in the world right now that has title deed to land. So 42% of commercial farmland. So that farmland had to be approved by the government of Zimbabwe. ZANU-PF under Robert Mugabe had to approve every one of those sales. So between 1980 and 2000, you cannot include at least 42% of the farmland as having been stolen from Africans because the government was the first buyer. It had first right of refusal. The government of Zimbabwe could have bought all of that land or any of that land, and it did buy some of that land. But you'll find a strong correlation to land purchases and title deed going to senior members of ZANU-PF, the Zimbabwe Republic Police, to the Zimbabwe Defense Force, not to poor Black Africans or to war veterans. Yes, that's the true story. 42% of land. So no, not land stolen. Yes, land has been stolen, but that's a disingenuous argument and dishonest. And this was not an action that needed to take place. Next, while European settlers, tirelessly working to cast Zimbabwe into total economic ruin. If the United States wanted total ruin in Zimbabwe, why in God's green acre has the United States provided over $4 billion of grant assistance to Zimbabwe, to the healthcare sector, so that people could live, to provide emergency food supplies when the economy collapsed and the farming sector collapsed after the farm invasions and again later on? Why? It doesn't make any sense. What's the point of that? We don't get the money back. We're not getting good press for it. We do it because it's part of our foreign policy in the United States to help friends, partners, and allies and people out of compassion around the world. Now, is that an entire foreign policy? No, it's an element of our foreign policy. But if we were trying to crush Zimbabwe, there are far simpler ways to do it. Simply withhold the $318 million last year and watch people starve or die from HIV because the government of Zimbabwe does not provide them with antiretrovirals. It's the United States government that's paying for those antiretrovirals, those who have CD4 counts below the threshold by UNAIDS to take them. So that simply doesn't hold water. Now, the next point in here that I'd like to talk about, I'll have to look at my notes for this to make sure I get this clear, is while European settlers stole land, displaced and killed African people, stole mineral wealth, there were no sanctions or any action taken against them by any European country in the United States. Well, that's simply factually incorrect and ignores history. And sadly for these authors, hundreds of millions of people were alive at that time and remain alive today. And a lot of us are capable of reading and researching and finding out for ourselves. Simply untrue. Now, so on the 11th of November, 1965, Ian Smith and the Rhodesian Front declared UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, from the United Kingdom. They were a colony of the United Kingdom, and they declared their independence on the 11th of November, 1965. Now, the authors of this article claim that there were no sanctions ever imposed by any European country or the United States. However, just a month later, on the 12th of December, the United Kingdom imposed total economic sanctions against Rhodesia. And that remained in effect until 1979, 1980. So that simply isn't true. Now, we can argue the efficacy and the effectiveness of the sanctions, which were largely ineffective, particularly early on. But this was later followed up on the 16th of December by UN sanctions in 1966. 16 December 1966, so a year later, the United Nations imposed sanctions on Rhodesia, which signatories were obliged to follow. The United States followed those sanctions. The United Kingdom followed those sanctions. But South Africa did not. This was followed in 1968 by comprehensive mandatory sanctions imposed. The others were voluntary, but these were mandatory by the United Nations under Resolution 253 on the 29th of May, 1968. So there are three rounds of sanctions right there. So to claim that no Europeans and the Americans never imposed sanctions on Rhodesia is simply a lie. Now, the efficacy, the effectiveness of them was minimal early on. Absolutely true. Because the South Africans allowed the Rhodesians to use their rail network, as did the Portuguese, who still controlled Mozambique. So the rail lines remained open to ship goods to and from Beira and to South Africa, Beira and Mozambique. And so they're ineffective. But that changed after 1975. In 1977, Forster, the South African prime minister, shut the railroads down, and Rhodesia could no longer rely on sanction busting to the degree that it had in the past. So sanctions began to take effect and bite in the late 1970s. So they're simply dishonest. But this is the sort of propaganda and emotional appeal that you find perpetuated throughout the world by people who simply try to distort the argument. They claim that we never bothered to sanction Rhodesia, but we sanctioned Zimbabwe, and that somehow makes us morally wrong. Well, that's not true. That is simply not true. So there you have that. So that's why I mentioned those propaganda stories. And that's important to understand as people distort the facts. No, the United States is not trying to impoverish Zimbabwe. The United States is trying to force those now, what's the total? 85 individuals and 56 companies who are still remain on the list of restrictions. We're trying to encourage them to change their behavior and stop oppressing Zimbabweans. And if you think oppression has ended, one need look only at the military shooting and killing protesters who were demanding a vote disclosure last year when the vote was delayed after an election. So it continues to this day. And this is the reason for these restrictions, because we care about the liberties and freedoms of the Zimbabweans, despite the depiction by those in the propaganda world. So why won't people invest in Zimbabwe? Well, that's a fair question. One of the challenges here is that the list of targeted sanctions gives a lot of people the false impression that there are, in fact, sanctions against Zimbabwe. And it's not just Zimbabweans that have that impression, or Cyril Ramaphosa, apparently, but also Americans and American entities. Oftentimes, they mistakenly believe that they can't do business in Zimbabwe for fear of penalty. And the penalties can be quite severe, $250,000 fine, and or up to $1 million if convicted of evading the sanctions with these entities and individuals in Zimbabwe. So I understand why people are reticent, but one need simply educate themselves. And if you're a business person in Zimbabwe and you want to do business with the U.S., for example, you simply need to reach out and contact folks and have the correct information to explain to them, point them in the right direction, and you can do business. So I understand why some people worry about that. But the real reason why people aren't doing business in Zimbabwe is tied initially to the chaos, the economic chaos, the macroeconomic policies, the hyperinflation, the removal of the Zimbabwean dollar as a currency, replaced by a basket of currencies, primarily the dollar and the rand, and then other problems with the economy. And one of the biggest was the 2008 indigenization law, which was a race-based law that discriminated against foreign direct investment and also against Zimbabweans. That's correct. It discriminated against Zimbabweans. So the law, which was passed, was signed, it was known as the Indigenization Economic Empowerment Bill, was signed into law on the 9th of March, 2008. And it sailed through Parliament that previous September before it was signed by Mugabe. So the law described indigenization as a deliberate involvement of indigenous Zimbabweans in the economic activities of the country, to which they had no access, so as to have an equitable distribution of natural resources. Well, that sounds great. That sounds fair. Further, it described a Zimbabwean as any person who, before April 18, 1980, was disadvantaged by unfair discrimination on the grounds of his or her race and any descendant of such person, and includes any company, association, syndicate, or partnership of which indigenous Zimbabweans form the majority of members or hold the controlling interest. Now, I have a couple problems with that. Those who follow me know that, first off, that means that only a small number of people in Zimbabwe could actually profit from this. And that small number of people, if you follow the law, would be the San, the Bushmen, the 5,000 or so who remain in Zimbabwe to this day. They're the only indigenous people in Zimbabwe. Yeah, that's true. The Bantu and the Europeans migrated in there and colonized in different ways. Bantu colonization and migration took place long before European, but the Europeans came in the late 19th century and they colonized as well. So if it's indigenous, then it's only the San. So first, that's the first problem. Second problem with it is it's a race-based law. So it's saying that anyone before April 18th, 1980, so it only applies to people before the state and obviously to black Zimbabweans and their descendants. So a child born in 2000 who wants to do business in Zimbabwe and creates a business, say an application company that writes apps for the internet, must give 51% of the equity that they work hard for to a black Zimbabwean, even if they're a white Zimbabwean. Now, what's that all about? Now, this atrocious race-based law was amended in 2019, and now it applies largely just to the diamond sector, diamond and platinum mining only now. So that's a nice change of pace. But an article that an analyst, Victor Boromo, wrote in March of 2019 for The Independent, he talked about this. Now, he did say that what Zimbabwe did is it's not very different than a lot of countries. Many countries have policies that require 51-49% shareholding adopted by Zimbabwe. That's true, including the United States, China, France, Italy, Brazil, Singapore, South Korea, Japan, Italy, Taiwan, and South Africa. Absolutely true. But almost all those countries, that's based on citizenship, not race or ethnicity, which is what the Zimbabwe law was based on. That's what makes it atrocious and what makes it such a dangerous law. That law alone has had a far more dampening impact and effect on foreign direct investment in Zimbabwe than any supposed sanctions applied by the United States ever have. So there you have it, folks. Indigenization. That's that law. Now, that law is amended and it only affects a small sector. But let me ask you this question. Do you want to invest in Zimbabwe if you're not from Zimbabwe, when the government can simply take away your assets? Now, this has happened over and over. Of course, the Saudis famously nationalized oil assets and defrauded companies that had invested capital there for decades to produce the oil. And it's happened in many places around the world. But in Zimbabwe, it repeatedly happens. People who bought farmland after 1980, under majority rule, legally, legitimately, went to the government, said, I'd like to buy this farmland, and then they had to wait for the government to approve the sale, bought the land, developed it, hired people to work on it, only to have their farms invaded, to be called settlers, to be discriminated against based on their skin pigmentation. Some killed, all impoverished, having all they worked for stolen by a government that sanctioned farm invasions and then passed laws to defraud them of the opportunity to own land. And then we follow this up with an indigenization law, which strips entities of their capital by forcing them to give it to someone. simply on the basis of their skin color. The government undermines its economy with its macroeconomic policies, destroys its currency, replaces its currency, eliminates the use of foreign currency, comes up with a new currency, allows foreign currency to be used again. These are the problems in Zimbabwe, not to mention state-owned enterprises and other serious structural macroeconomic policy problems for the country of Zimbabwe. These are the reasons that Zimbabwe is impoverished. The actions and policies of ZANU-PF, not the limited targeted sanctions, which currently affect 85 individuals who are senior ZANU-PF government officials and who have committed or are suspected of committing all the offenses I have talked about against the Zimbabwean people. Not against the American people, but against the Zimbabwean people and 56 companies and entities. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, debunking the Zimbabwe sanctions myth. That's right, debunking sanctions myth for Zimbabwe. That's what this video is about. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have any questions or you take umbrage with anything I've said, feel free to contact me. My email is available under my account on the site or on my channel. And also, you can write comments below. If you're for or against, feel free to say so. I ask that people don't be abusive, because I'll delete those comments. But discourse is important, so please feel free to contribute to the discussion. Again, if you like the content, I ask that you push that button down there and subscribe to my channel. And also be sure to push the little bell icon to the side so that you will get notifications anytime that I go online with a live stream or a video that I produce. And comments are welcome and encouraged. Discourse is what makes us all get through this in a better fashion. And finally, I ask that please give me a like on the video if you like the video at all. Likes drive viewership, and the more people that watch the video and give it a like, the more likely it is that YouTube will promote it for other visitors so that they can become aware of the channel and drive traffic here. Please share this with your friends. Share it with your foes. If you know someone that has a different opinion of these issues, feel free to let them know about the channel. So I thank you once again for tuning in to Indaba Africa. This has been Chris, and this is my video today on debunking the Zimbabwe sanctions myth. Take care, folks. Hang in there.